and it was not cross-referenced in the chapter on patient compliance or indeed in any other chapter. However, merely printing such phrases as spirit attack, trance state, and cultural relativism granted them an ex-cathedra legitimacy. Where Merck went, others could follow without fear of sounding like cranks. 10 years ago, hardly any medical school or residency curricula included cross-cultural training. In 1995, for the first time, the National Guidelines for Training Psychiatry Residents stipulated that they learn to assess cultural influences on their patients' problems. In 1996, the American Academy of Family Physicians endorsed a set of recommended core curriculum guidelines on culturally sensitive and competent healthcare. Among the resources suggested by the guidelines' authors was Bafa Bafa, a simulation game in which the participants are divided into two mythical cultures, each assigned a different set of manners, conventions, and taboos. Each group inevitably misperceives the other by applying its own cultural standards. Each inevitably offends the other, and each, until the groups meet at the end of the game to discuss the pitfalls of ethnocentrism, is inevitably certain that its culture is superior. Today, most medical students at least brush shoulders with cross-cultural issues, and some form more than a glancing acquaintance. The University of Wisconsin recently developed an integrated multicultural curriculum that includes panel and group discussions, case conferences, student interviews, role-playing exercises, and home visits. At Harvard, all first-year students are required to take a course called Patient, Doctor, I, significantly not Doctor, Patient, I, in which they learn to work with interpreters, study Kleinman's 8 questions, and ponder such conundrums as, can an American pediatrician truly explain a surgical consent form to newly arrived parents of a Southeast Asian baby? And is it ethical to use psychotherapy when therapist and patient are ethnically unmatched? Some residency programs are evolving along the same lines. At San Francisco General Hospital, all family practice residents are required to do a rotation at the refugee clinic, in which, since 1979, more than 20,000 refugees speaking dozens of languages have received health screenings. Francesca Farr, who persuaded the Hmong man to let his wife take her isoniazid, was a social worker at the refugee clinic. In addition to briefings on hepatitis B, thalassemia, and intestinal parasites, the residence's orientation manuals includes an article on assessing symptoms in Southeast Asian survivors of mass violence and torture, a set of guidelines for working with interpreters, and an 8-page chart that compares the social and cultural customs of the Vietnamese, Cambodians, Lao, and Hmong. High-mindedness in the big leagues is all very well, but how much of this kind of thing was likely to trickle down to a place like Merced? As it turns out, a lot more than I expected. In 1996, the Merced County Health Department invited a Seattle-based cross-cultural education program called Bridging the Gap to train its nursing, administrative, and interpreting staffs in advocacy skills and cultural competence. The health department now produces a segment for the local Hmong cable channel that features a tour of MCMC and answers, in Hmong, some commonly asked questions, including, why are doctors so rude? At MCMC, a 55-year-old Hmong man nearly died recently from a perforated bowel after his family took 3 days to consent to surgery. Because he stayed in the hospital for more than 2 months and every resident either cared for him or debated his case in the corridors, he galvanized interest in such questions as, could Zinengs be certified? Like clergy to visit MCMC patients? Could monks serve as cultural brokers? If MCMC employed certified interpreters instead of lab assistants and nurses' aides who translated on the side, a plan that had previously been dismissed as too expensive, would hospital stays be shortened and costs thereby reduced? This last question was particularly germane since managed care had drastically eroded MCMC's referrals and hospitalizations, and the county was so nervous about the resulting deficit that it was planning to lease the hospital to a large healthcare corporation. But change comes hard, especially in the trenches. It is one thing to read in medical school that the ideal doctor-patient-interpreter seating configuration is a right angle, with the patient and interpreter forming the hypotenuse, and another to recollect the diagram in a room full of gesticulating Hmong toward the end of a 24-hour shift. When I heard of Merced's latest cross-cultural efforts, I remembered an elderly Hmong woman with stomach cancer whom I had once met at MCMC. Her family was unable to understand either the resident's English or his drawings of the digestive system, had refused to consent to surgery. I had expected the resident to move heaven and earth to bring in a decent interpreter. Instead, I found him in the preceptor library, his head bowed over four articles on poorly differentiated gastric adenocarcinoma. I also remembered a morbidity and mortality conference during which Dan Murphy presented the case of a middle-aged Hmong woman rendered comatose by a stroke. Her family had staged an insurrection at her bedside demanding that her intravenous and nasogastric tubes be removed and that a Zineng be permitted into the intensive care unit. MCMC had acceded, and she had died. Every time Dan tried to steer the discussion toward cultural issues, the residents yanked it back to a debate on the relative merits of labetalol and hydralazine as antihypertensives. This is the kind of thinking that has begotten the cartoon version MD, the all-head, no-heart formalist who, when presented with a problem, would rather medicate it, scan it, suture it, splint it, excise it, anesthetize it, or autopsy it rather than communicate with it. Fortunately, most real-life doctors, including MCMCs, are not automatons. However, they often seem myopically over-reliant on what Kleiman calls the culture of biomedicine, which when he says it sounds every bit as exotic as the culture of the Ainu or the Waiwai. Their investment in this culture does not make them resist change on general principle. Quite the contrary. They eagerly embrace new drugs, technologies, and procedures as soon as clinical trials prove their effectiveness. Yet they may not feel the same way about Kleinman's 8 questions. But diseases aren't caused by spirits. Why should I indulge delusions? Or his proposition that ethnographic methods should be a part of every doctor's job description. But I'm not an anthropologist. I'm a gastroenterologist. The same doctors who listened to continuing medical education audio cassettes on their car stereos, intent on keeping up with every innovation that might improve their outcome statistics, may regard cross-cultural medicine as a form of political bamboozlement, an assault on their rationality rather than a potentially life-saving therapy. On the wall above my desk, flanked by pictures of Leah and her family, are two Xeroxed passages that, in a jaundiced mood, I once captioned "The Hmong Way" and "The American Way." "The Hmong Way" is the page from the Fresno Mental Health Report that summarized the Zineng's successful treatment of his patient's swollen penis. "The American Way" is a page from the Journal of the American Medical Association. It was excerpted from an article called "Doctors Have Feelings Too." Its author, a Harvard Medical School instructor named William M. Zinn, posited that because doctors may be busy doing multiple other tasks, maintaining a clinical distance, or harboring guilt about negative reactions to their patients, they run the risk of overlooking their feelings. So if you're a doctor, how can you recognize that you're having a feeling? Some tips from Dr. Zinn. Most emotions have physical counterparts. Anxiety may be associated with a tightness of the abdomen or excessive diaphoresis. Anger may be manifested by generalized muscle tightness or clenching of the jaw. Sexual arousal may be noted by a tingling of the loins or piloerection. And sadness may be felt by conjunctival injection or heaviness of the chest. I first read this article at Bill Selvage's house. Every night while I waited for Bill to come home from MCMC, I alternated between his old anthropology texts and his piles of medical journals and pondered which was more arcane. I remember sitting on the dilapidated sofa thinking that if any of my Hmong friends heard that American doctors had to read an article in order to learn how to tell if they were angry, they would never ever return to MCMC. In lurched Bill, nearly ataxic from fatigue after a 33-hour shift. I read him the paragraph that is now on my wall. We both laughed so hard we probably woke his fundamentalist neighbors, the ones who had smashed their TV set and danced a jig around it. Bill assured me that he was so remarkably in touch with his feelings that he could tell if he was anxious or sad without benefit of diaphoresis or conjunctival injection. I believed him. Bill was a GP of the old school, the sort of doctor who relieved his stress by going to MCMC's newborn nursery, selecting a crying baby and walking back and forth with it until it quieted down. Yet I feared that Dr. Zinn had a point. Medicine, as it is taught in the United States, does an excellent job of separating students from their emotions. The desensitization starts on the first day of medical school, when each student is given a scalpel with which to penetrate his or her cadaver. The ideal patient, as it is nicknamed, since it can't be killed, never complains, and never sues. The first cut is always difficult. 3 months later, the students are chunking pieces of excised human fat into a garbage can as nonchalantly as if they were steak trimmings. The emotional skin thickening is necessary, or so goes the conventional wisdom, because without it, doctors would be overwhelmed by their chronic exposure to suffering and despair. Dissociation is part of the job. That is why doctors do not treat their own relatives. Feelings would handicap their effectiveness. Why, beyond routine issues of sterility, the heads of open-heart patients are screened from the surgeon's view, individuality would be a distraction. And why Neil Ernst avoided Lia Lee after she returned from Fresno with irreparable brain damage. He couldn't bear it. At Stanford Medical School, in an admirable attempt to fight this trend, students are informed during the first semester that their empathy may already have peaked. If they succumb to the norm, it will plunge steadily during their 4 years of medical school and their first year of residency. "What changes?" an appalled student once asked. His professor answered, "As you get more skilled, you belittle what you had before you started." Stanford, like several other medical schools, is trying to bring back what has been called the whole doctor, whole patient model, in which the doctor brings his or her full humanity, not just the part that aced the MCATs, to the hospital, and the patient is viewed as a complete person, not just the appendix in room 416. This model is nothing new. In fact, it is what all doctors used to be taught. As William Osler once said, or is said to have said, "Ask not what disease the person has, but rather what person the disease has. Between 1992 and 1995, the percentage of medical school seniors who chose to become generalists, internists, general pediatricians, and family physicians nearly doubled, a trend that may help bring Osler's charge back into circulation. Some of these choices have been influenced by economic factors. Managed healthcare plans prefer primary to subspecialized care because it's cheaper. But others are surely idealistic. If there were more Osler-type generalists around, the Hmong, among others, would stand to benefit. The anthropologist Elizabeth Curtin has commented that a Hmong patient she knew referred to a specialist for further treatment did not ask the referring physician to find someone skilled or famous. He asked, "Do you know someone who would care for me and love me?" It was probably unfair to me to caption Dr. Zinn's article, The American Way. Once, several years ago, when I romanticized the Hmong more, though admired them less, than I do now, I had a conversation with a Minnesota epidemiologist at a healthcare conference. Knowing she had worked with the Hmong, I started to lament the insensitivity of Western medicine. The epidemiologist looked at me sharply. "Western medicine saves lives," she said. Oh, right. I had to keep reminding myself of that. It was all that cold, linear, Cartesian, non-Hmong-like thinking which saved my father from colon cancer, saved my husband and me from infertility. And if she had swallowed her anticonvulsants from the start, might have saved Leah from brain damage. Dwight Conkergood's philosophy of healthcare as a form of barter rather than a one-sided relationship ignores the fact that for better or worse, Western medicine is one-sided. Doctors endure medical school and residency in order to acquire knowledge that their patients do not have. Until the culture of medicine changes, it would be asking a lot of them to consider, much less adopt, the notion that, as Francesca Farr put it, our view of reality is only a view, not reality itself. However, I don't think it would be too much to ask them to acknowledge their patients' as realities, to avoid the kind of blind spot that made a Merced Health Department employee once write about a child from a family that views the entire universe as sacred. Name, Leah Lee. Principal language, Hmong. Ethnic group, Hmong. Religion, none. Dwight Conkergood's Zinning may have had no trouble crossing the threshold between earth and sky, natural and supernatural, medical and spiritual. Regular mortals find the transit difficult. How difficult was borne out to me the night I invited Bill Selvidge and Suki Walker to dinner at the Red Snapper Seafood Grotto. Since my experience with Jonas Vangay, I was steering clear of the cask and cleaver. Although they knew each other by reputation, Bill and Suki had never met. I thought that because they were both Peace Corps veterans and because they both worked with the Hmong, Bill as a doctor, Suki as a psychotherapist, they would have much in common. Over our fish, we discussed shamanism, about which Suki knew a great deal. She volunteered that she had once told a doctor at MCMC that a Tsining of her acquaintance had a direct line to God. The doctor had responded, "Well, I have a direct line to biochemistry." Although it was clear where Suki's sympathies lay, Bill did not appear offended. By dessert, we had moved on to Leah's case in particular and cross-cultural pediatrics in general. "You have to act on behalf of the most vulnerable person in the room," said Bill. "And that's the child. The child's welfare is more important than the parent's beliefs. You have to do what's best for the child, even if the parents oppose it, because if the child dies, She won't get the chance to decide 20 years down the road if she wants to accept her parents' belief or if she wants to reject them. She's going to be dead. Well, said Suki tartly, that's the job you have taken on in your profession.
I'd feel the same way if I weren't a doctor, said Bill. I would feel I am my brother's keeper.
That's tyranny, said Suki. What if you have a family who rejects surgery because they believe an illness has a spiritual cause? What if they see a definite possibility of eternal damnation for their child if she dies from the surgery? Next to that, death might not seem so important. Which is more important, the life or the soul?
I make no apology, said Bill. The life comes first.
The soul, said Suki. Chapter 19. The Sacrifice. Long before Shi Yi turned into a tiny red ant and bit the evil Da on the testicle, he spent 3 years apprenticed to a sorcerer. He learned how to change himself into anything he wished, to kill death, to fly like the wind, to heal the sick, and to raise the dead. Shi Yi's services as a healer were sorely needed because there was much illness in the world. This is how the illness had come. The wife of a wicked god named Nyong laid an egg as large as a pig house. For 3 years, the egg did not hatch. Nyong's father chanted to the egg and, in response, heard the jabbering voices of many evil das inside it. He ordered Nyong to burn the egg, but Nyong refused. So the egg burst, and out swarmed the das. The first thing they did was eat Nyong's wife, down to the last bone, hair, and eyelash. Then, still hungry, they came after Nyong. But Nyong opened the door and led from the sky where he lived to the earth. Through it flew the das, as big as water buffaloes and as red as fire, with showers of sparks in their wake. Nyong was safe. But from that day on, the people of the earth have known illness and death. Shi Yi spent many years fighting the das and restoring sick people to health. He was assisted by a winged horse, a bowl of holy water, a set of magical healing tools, and a troop of familiar spirits. One day, Nyong murdered Shi Yi's infant son and tricked Shi Yi into eating the flesh. When Shi Yi realized what he had done, he was so stricken with grief and horror that he fled the earth and climbed the staircase up through the door in the sky. To avenge his son's death, he pierced both of Nyong's eyes. Nyong, blind and enraged, now lives at the foot of a mountain in the sky, and Shi Yi lives in a cave at its summit, surrounded by his familiar spirits. Shi Yi never returned to earth, but he did not leave its people entirely at the mercy of illness and death. After he climbed the staircase through the sky, he poured the bowl of holy water into his mouth, and then he spat it with great force on his healing tools, a saber, a gong, a rattle, and a pair of finger bells. The tools broke into pieces and fell to earth. Anyone who was sprayed with holy water or who caught a fragment of one of Shi Yi's tools was elected to be a Zining, a host for a healing spirit. The door in the sky is now closed to everyone but Zinings. When they pursue the lost soul of a sick person, they summon Shi Yi's familiar spirits and ride Shi Yi's flying horse up the staircase through the sky. In order to deceive any evil das they may meet en route, they pretend they are Shi Yi, and thus they partake in the first healer's cunning, courage, and greatness. The Zining, who was to perform a healing ceremony for Lia, brought his own tools. Saber, gong, rattle, finger bells. He also brought his own flying horse. The horse was a board about 10 feet long and 10 inches wide, When attached to a pair of sawhorse-like supports that fitted into four slots, became a bench. To the people who filled the Lees' living room, the bench was not a piece of furniture, nor was it a metaphor. It was truly a flying horse, just as to a devout Roman Catholic, the bread and the wine are not a symbol of Christ's body and blood, but the real thing. The Lees had risen well before dawn. Four told me, "We must have the Ning ceremony early in the morning when it is cool, because that is when the soul can come back better. Also, if it is hot, the pig will get tired and die." I thought, but the pig is going to get killed anyway. Then I realized that a dead pig cannot be sacrificed. The sun was rising when I arrived, sending pale shafts of light through the door that opened onto East 12th Street. Two translucent plastic painter's tarps had been laid over the threadbare brown wall-to-wall carpet to protect it from the blood of the pig, or rather, pigs, since a small pig was to be sacrificed for the whole family, and a large pig was to be sacrificed for Leah. The Lees had bought them the previous day at a local farm, paying $225, which came partly from welfare savings and partly from relatives' contributions for the pair. On the electric stove, three large aluminum pots filled with water that could be used to singe the pigs' bristles had been set to boil. Bags of fresh vegetables and herbs grown by the Lees and their relatives rested next to the mortar and pestle Fo had brought from Laos. They would be used in the preparation of the traditional festal dishes. Minced pork and vegetables rolled in rice wrappers. Pig bones and meat boiled with homegrown greens, chopped intestines, liver, heart, and lungs, the dish Mayin called doo-doo soup, raw jellied pig's blood, stewed chicken, two kinds of pepper sauce, and steamed rice. Among Proverbs says, "With friends, flavorless vegetables are as tasty as meat, and water is as good as wine." However, the combination of friends and good food is better still. The feast, which was to follow the Ning ceremony, would continue far into the night. Early this morning, Nakao had used a special paper punch to cut a stack of spirit money, which would pay the pig for its soul and settle other spiritual accounts. The spirit money, thick and cream-colored and pinked into scallops, lay on the carpet next to the Tsining's altar, which represented the cave of Shi Yi. In Laos, the altar would have been made from one of a pair of identical trees. One would have been left standing, and one would have been felled with an axe in the direction of the setting sun. Here, the altar was a crude wooden table that had been covered with the sports section of the Merced Sun Star, arrayed on top of a refrigerator ad that said, "No down payment for 90 days, were the Tsining's sacred tools, the same ones Shi Yi had used, a short saber ornamented with red and white streamers, an ancient iron gong, a monkey bone with a padded end wrapped in black cloth, which was used to beat the gong, a tambourine-sized iron ring strung with rattling metal discs, and two finger bells which looked like bronze donuts and enclosed little tin-tin nebula made of jingling metal pellets. Next to the tools was a brown plastic bowl containing rice and a single uncooked egg, sustenance for the familiar spirits. Three styrofoam coffee cups and a white china bowl, a lake into which the Tsining's soul could plunge if he were pursued by evil das, were filled with holy water. A small candle at the front of the altar, not yet lit, would shed light on the unseen realm into which the Tsining was to travel. I had read a number of ethnographic commentaries on the power and influence of Tsinings. Somehow, I had never imagined that when I finally met the ultimate metaphysical interlocutor, the great plea bargainer for the soul, the preeminent champion in the struggle for the demonic, to cite three of the many reverential epithets I had come across, he would be sitting in front of a television set, watching a Winnie the Pooh cartoon. The Tsingning who was to perform today's ceremonies was named Cha Kuo Lee. He wore blue flip-flops, black pants, and a white t-shirt decorated with dancing pandas. Mei Ying Zhang had told me all Tsingnings were skinny because they expended so much energy in the shaking trance during which they traveled to the realm of the unseen. And indeed, Cha Kuo Lee, who looked to be in his late 40s, was thin and muscular, with sharp features and a stern expression. It was against his code of honor to charge for his services, especially with the Lees, who were members of his clan. And although some families voluntarily paid him, he was forced to live on public assistance. However, he always received compensation in the form of the heads and the right front legs of the pigs over whose sacrifices he presided. After eating the meat, he left the lower jaws to dry outside his apartment and then added them to a collection he kept on a shelf to be ritually burned at the end of the Meng year. At that time, the pigs' soul would be released from their duties as proxies for the souls of the people for whom they had given their lives and allowed to be reborn. In Laos, Cha Kuo Lee had burned his pig jaws in a fire pit. In Merced, he burned them in a disposable turkey roasting pan. Then he placed the charmed remains in the branches of a tree outside town, beneath the sky through which they had already journeyed. After the smaller pig, a tan and white female was carried into the living room and laid on one of the plastic tarps, the Tsingning performed the day's first order of business, a ceremony to safeguard the health and well-being of the family for the coming year. The Lee family stood in a closely packed huddle in the middle of the living room. Wearing a black cloth headdress, the Tsingning tied a cord around the pig's neck. The pig grunted softly. Then he ran the cord from the pig to the Lees, wrapping it tightly around the whole group. The pig's soul was thus bonded to the souls it would protect. The Tsingning regarded each person's soul as a tripartite entity composed of one part that, after death, would stand guard at the grave, one part that would go to the land of the dead, and one part that would be reincarnated. All three parts would be secured today. Then the pig's throat was slit by a Lee cousin, not by the Tsingning, who must always maintain good relations with the animals of whom he has requested such a priceless gift. In Laos, this ceremony would have taken place in the Lees' house, which Nikau and Pho had built to shelter not only their family, but also a host of kindly domestic spirits. The chief household spirit, who lived in the central pillar above the place where the placentas of the Lee sons were buried, the spirits of the ancestors, who lived in the four side pillars, the spirits of wealth, who lived near the uphill wall, the spirit who watched over the livestock, who lived in the downhill door, and the spirits of the two fireplaces. The presence of these spirits would have been felt by everyone in the house. It seemed to me that at 37 East 12th Street, Apartment A, where there were no pillars, no fireplaces, and indeed, according to the Lees, no benevolent spirits, because it was rented, the maintenance of a sacred atmosphere was an uphill battle. The television was still on, though without sound. Winnie the Pooh had been succeeded by a wrestling match between Hulk Hogan and Randy Macho Man Savage, broadcast from Atlantic City. 5 feet from the altar on the other side of the wall hummed a refrigerator that contained a case of Budweisers, one of which would later be consumed by the Tsingning. To the left of the front door through which the familiar spirits would pass, there was a king-size carton of Attend's youth diapers. The door was open. This worried me. What if an American were to stroll past and see a dead pig on the floor and 9 people tied up with twine? While the Tsingning prepared for the next ceremony, several of the Lees' male relatives carried the slaughtered pig into the parking lot, which fortunately was behind the apartment building and could not be seen from the street. First, they poured scalding water over the carcass and scraped the hide with knives. Then,
they expertly gutted the pig, threw the offal in a rainbow Losuds detergent pail, unfurled and recoiled the intestines, and rinsed the abdominal cavity with a green garden hose. Rivulets of bloody water dotted with bits of hair and pig flesh flowed through the parking lot. Cheng, Mei, Yer, Tru, and Mai watched with interest, but not surprise. Like children raised on a farm, they were familiar with death, and indeed could probably have done the job themselves. They had all learned how to kill and pluck chickens before they were 8, and the older ones had helped their parents butcher several pigs. When we walked back inside the apartment, I could tell in an instant that there had been a sea change. By some unaccountable feat of sorcery, I was never able to figure out exactly how it had happened. The bathos had been exorcised from apartment A. Everyone could feel the difference. The Lee children, who talked and giggled as they walked from the parking lot, fell silent as soon as they crossed the threshold. The television was off. The candle on the altar had been lit. A joss stick was burning, filling the apartment with smoke trails that would guide the familiar spirits that Zi Ning had put on a black silk jacket with indigo cuffs and a red sash. His feet were bare. He had shrugged all of the American incongruities off his outer aspect, and his inner aspect, the quality that had singled him out for spiritual election, now shone through bright and hard. I saw that I had underestimated him. It was Leah's turn now. Fo and Nikau believed that her condition was probably beyond the reach of spiritual healing. Another Zi Ning had told them that medicines must have hurt her irreparably, because if the cause were spiritual, the frequency of their Ning ceremonies would certainly have restored her ability to talk. However, within her status quo, there were degrees of illness. They hoped this Zi Ning would make Leah happier so that she would stop crying at night, and there was still the faintest flicker of a chance, not altogether extinguished even after years of failed sacrifices, that Leah's soul would be found after all, that the Das who were keeping it would accept the pig's soul in its stead, and that she would be restored to health. Fo sat in the middle of the living room on a red metal folding chair, wearing black pants and a black and blue blouse. American clothes, but traditional Hmong colors. The same colors that Zi Ning was wearing. A yard of shining black hair fell down her back. Leah sat on her lap, bare-legged, wearing a striped polo shirt and a diaper. Fo nestled Leah's head in the crook of her neck, smoothing her hair and whispering in her ear. Leah fit into the curves of her mother's body as tightly as a newborn infant. The Zi Ning placed a bundle of spirit money, Leah's expired life visa, which he would attempt to renew, on the shoulder of her polo shirt. A Lee cousin waved a live brown chicken in the air. It would be sacrificed for Leah's hoop li, her soul calling, a version of the same ceremony that had installed her soul in her body when she was an infant. After it was boiled, the chicken would be examined to find out if Leah's soul had returned. Tight feet, firm eyes, an upcurled tongue, and a translucent cranium would be good auspices. Of these, the most important sign was the feet, a toe which did not match its mates, which, like a Hmong who failed to conform to the group ethic, did not fit gracefully into its community, would signal disharmony and disequilibrium. The cousin chanted to the chicken, "I hope your legs are good. I hope your eyes are good. I hope your tongue is good. I hope your beak is good. I hope your head is clear." Leah was surrounded by her entire family and by more than 20 of her relatives. Their solicitude converged on her motionless form like sunlight focused on a magnifying glass until it burns. D. Korda had once said, "Leah knew how to love,
and how to let people love her. Whatever else she had lost, Leah still knew how to be loved. Four kissed Leah's nose and said, "You look very happy." One of the cousin's sons took the chicken to the kitchen and quickly sliced its neck and shook the spurting blood into a plastic garbage bag. Leah's pig, a bigger, browner one, was carried into the living room, its trotters bound with twine. Because Leah was a girl, her pig was male. Her soul bond would be a kind of marriage. It lay snorting and struggling on its plastic tarp. The thinning tied a cord around its neck, then wrapped it around the integral unit of Four and Leah, linking Leah's soul to her mother's as well as to the pig's. He walked to the circuit from pig to Four and Leah many times, shaking his rattle loudly so that Leah's soul, wherever it was, would hear it. Then he beat his gong again and again to summon his familiar spirits. Finally, he tossed the polished halves of a water buffalo horn on the floor to divine whether the spirits had heard him. When both horns landed flat side up, the answer was no. When one horn landed flat side up and one horn landed flat side down, the answer was ambiguous. Finally, when both horns landed flat side down, he knew that his spirits had heard their master's call. The pig had to be paid for the great gift it was about to give Leah. So the Tsining took a thick sheaf of spirit money from the floor next to the altar and placed it next to the pig. Squatting low, he spoke quietly to the pig, explaining that it would be well rewarded for its work, and that at the end of the year, its soul would be set free from its obligations. He threw the divination horns again to see if the pig had accepted. When they told him yes, he thanked the pig, unwound the cord from the pig's neck and from Four and Leah, and brandished his saber to cut Leah's sickness away. Then he took one of the cups from the altar, poured some water in his mouth, and spat it out, as Shi Yi had done, making a trilling noise. "These are waters of gold and silver," he said. "They will wash the sickness clean." From the kitchen came the sound of a knife being sharpened. Two men lifted the pig into a pair of folding chairs. Three men held it down. A Li relative stuck it in the neck. It bellowed and thrashed. Another relative held a stainless steel bowl to catch the blood, but a good deal splattered on the plastic tarp, the carpet, and our bare feet. The Tsining took the pig's spirit money and held it in the torrent. The blood would indelibly mark the money as belonging to the pig. Calling his familiar spirits, each by name, the Tsining touched Leah's back with the finger bell he had moistened with the bloody spirit money. She, too, would now be marked, and any Das who wished her ill would be barred from touching her. The Tsining washed away more sickness. Then he took the spirit money from Leah's shoulder and placed it on the plank of the sacrificed pig. With the blood of the pig on her back, Leah could go anywhere in the world, even hundreds of miles away, and still be recognized as the child who needed healing. Since she no longer needed to be within sight of the Tsining, Fu carried her into the bedroom, laid her tenderly on the double bed, cushioned her legs with the blue blanket the family had brought from Laos, and turned on an electric fan. Leah's gaze, whatever it saw, was focused upward. Her glossy hair floated in the breeze. Now, the Tsining was ready for the most dangerous part of his mission. Standing in front of the bench, he flipped part of his cloth headdress over his face, completely blocking his sight. When the veil was down, he was blind to this world, but able to perceive the realm of the unseen. The veil, along with the incense, the mesmeric iteration of the gong and rattle, and the Tsining's own repetitive movements also helped him enter his ecstatic trance.
In Laos, he might have used opium, but it was not a necessity. When his familiar spirits were present, he could enter an altered state at will. The Tsineng sat on Shi Yi's winged horse, crossing and uncrossing his feet on the carpet, doing a rhythmic tap dance as the rattle he held in his right hand and finger bell he wore in his left hand echoed the sound of his horse's harness bells. Meanwhile, his assistant, a young man who wore black aviator glasses, beat the gong to tell the spirits that the journey was beginning. After a little more than half an hour, the assistant placed his hands on the Tsineng's waist. In a single movement, without missing a beat, the Tsineng rose to his feet and jumped backwards onto the bench. All his familiar spirits were in attendance. Without their aid, his body would have been too heavy for such a leap. At this point, the Tsineng was risking his life. During his trance, his own soul traveled far from his body, and if he fell before his soul returned, he would die. No one, not even the greatest Tsineng in the world, could help him. Even if he did not fall, he might encounter Das on his journey who wanted him dead, and it would take all his might and his guile to fight them off. The Tsineng started to gallop. Sometimes he was on top of the horse, sometimes on the ground. Sometimes he was the horse, neighing and whinnying. He chanted loudly in a minor key, singing incantations that were part Hmong and part Chinese. Even the Lees could not understand him, but they knew he was speaking to his familiar spirits and negotiating with Das for the release of Leah's captive soul. The front door had been shut for some time, and the room was very hot and close. The air was thick with incense. The gong clanged. The rattle jangled. Someone poured water on the joints of the bench to cool them down. Now the horse was flying up the staircase to the sky. Now the door in the sky was opening. Now the Tsineng was outside Nyong's home. Now he was climbing the mountain to Shi Yi's cave. While the Tsineng was on his journey, the cousin who had waved the chicken in the air, the soul caller, opened the front door and stood facing the street. A small table at his feet held the sacrificed chicken, some rice, an egg, a burning joss stick. In his right hand, he held a pair of divination horns, and in his left hand held a rattle. From time to time he tossed one or the other on the ground, judging the success of his work by the disposition of the horns or the lay of the metal discs. "I am calling you! I am calling you!" he chanted to Leah's soul. "I have an egg for you. I have rice for you. I have a chicken for you. I have everything waiting for you." Inside the apartment, the spirit money was burned and sent to the realm of the unseen. The gong sounded. The Tsineng's horse galloped faster and faster. The soul caller looked out toward East 12th Street and chanted, "Where are you? Where have you gone? Are you visiting your brother? Are you visiting your sister? Are you visiting your cousin? Are you looking at a flower? Are you in Laos? Are you in Thailand? Are you in the sky? Have you gone to the sun? Have you gone to the moon? Come home to your house. Come home to your mother. Come home to your father. Come home to your sisters. Come home to your brother. I'm calling you. I'm calling you. Come through this door. Come home to your family. Come home. 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 Come home.
Afterward to the 15th century anniversary edition. The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down was published 15 years ago. But I first walked into the Lees' apartment at 37 East 12th Street in Merced more than 24 years ago. On May 9th, 1988, I wrote in my college-ruled spiral notebook, "Barefoot mother, gently rocking child. Diaper, sweater, strings around wrist, like a baby, but she's so big. Mother kisses and strokes her." I had no idea what impact that silent child would end up having on me. Leah is, astonishingly, still alive. Most people in persistent vegetative states die within 6 months. The rest usually die within 5 years. Almost always in nursing facilities. Leah's family has cared for her at home for 5 times that long. She was once one of the most beautiful children I had ever seen. Now she is gaunt. Her skin, which used to be so smooth and fresh that I understood why Four couldn't stop stroking it, is dry and sallow. Her fingers are stiff and curled, but she is still scrupulously clean. Four is old now. No one knows exactly how old, since she doesn't know when she was born, and in fragile health, so her daughters, especially True, have shouldered Leah's care. It used to take more than 2 hours to prepare and feed Leah a meal, but after she inhaled food particles and contracted aspiration pneumonia one time too many, her family finally consented to a feeding tube. Now a meal takes only 10 minutes, but it's still a major undertaking to bathe Leah, dress her, change her diapers, suction her phlegm, and soothe her in the middle of the night. Her family continues to celebrate her birthday with an annual barbecue, and once or twice a year, a Tsining visits the house and an animal is sacrificed in hope not of healing Leah, but of lessening her daily suffering. Only her brainstem is said to be functional, but I believe Leah has some form of consciousness, or at least sense memory. I visited the Lees once when Four was out of town with a cousin. True had slept with Leah the previous night and said her sister had whimpered for hours. Leah knew something was missing. Her mother's familiar smell, I think, along with the sound of her voice and the contours of her body. Whenever I visit the Lees, I know Leah is not conscious of my presence. Nor was she the first time I met her, 1.5 years after her neurological crisis. But I am so acutely conscious of hers that our connection feels, somehow, like a relationship. Before we met, I would have considered Leah someone who cannot speak, laugh, think, work, or in my lexicon, contribute. Deserving of kindness, but of little value, a partial person, if a person at all. She taught me otherwise. How can I say she is not valuable when she means so much to the people around her? How can I say she has nothing to contribute when she altered the course of my family life, my life as a writer, and my whole way of thinking, and may also have influenced some of the people who have read about her? Is Leah still alive? That is always the first question. The next is, what happened to everyone else? Because I expected that the story of an epileptic Hmong toddler would attract about 17 readers, and judging from the size of my advance, so did my publisher. I am still taken by surprise whenever I receive a letter or an email about this book, though I am always glad to know someone else cares about the people who continue to matter so much to me. Nikau Lee died of congestive heart failure in 2003, and his family still feels his absence. Several years after his death,
May wrote me. When I was a kid, I remembered coming home crying because other kids made fun of me or was mean to me. And my dad used to always said that in my lifetime, I'll meet some people who'll treat me mean. And I'll just pray that I'll never be like them. And then I'll meet some very nice people, and I will take a little bit of them and make myself a better person. If Nikau were alive today, he would see continuing evidence that he and Four raised a family of well-educated, hard-working, very nice people. With the exception of the two eldest daughters, Chong and Zuo, who were in their mid-teens when they arrived in the United States, all of Leah's siblings have attended or graduated from college. Peng is a student. Cheng is a dental hygienist. Yur is a dental assistant. Tru works in her county's public assistance office. Mai works in a correctional institution, and Mei is a clinical health educator for Kaiser Permanente. She serves on Kaiser's Napa Solano Ethics Committee, mediating between families and physicians when they disagree on treatment decisions. Aside from the fact that few of the patients are Hmong, a role not so different from the one she played at age 12, serving as her parents' translator and go-between during Leah's visits to MCMC. When she was interviewed for the position, she says, I told them that before I worked in this field, I used to blame the doctors for all my parents' obstacles with Leah, because every day at home, all I saw was my parents trying everything they could do to make Leah better. Then, I started working here and realized no one was to blame. Leah's siblings all live in Northern California within an hour of each other. Five are married. Four has 29 grandchildren. Suong, Za, Fong, Cheng, Julie, Dorsey, Sandy, Chrissy, Danny, Ashley, Melody, Leslie, Sean, Stephanie, Karen, Catalina, Dao, Shane, Kristen, Sam, Caitlin, Sky, Michaela, Phelan, Savila, Kunlun, Elijah, Alexley, and Yuri. The eldest, 31 years old, and the youngest, 3, and 3 great-grandchildren, Titan, Kaylin, and Topanga. My 4 indispensable guides through Hmong culture still live in the Central Valley. Blia Yao Mua left his job counseling Hmong students at Minnesota College for Adult Learners and moved to Sacramento, where he works in financial services and marketing. My friends ask me, why business? He says. I tell them that after some of my students graduate, they show me their paycheck from the job they quit to go to college. It's bigger than the paycheck they have now. I have nightmares and can't sleep. We promised we would show them a better life, but the dream wasn't there. The money wasn't there. Now that I can help people make money, I don't have nightmares anymore. The indefatigable Dang Moore, who now prefers to be called Dan because too many Americans made jokes about his first name, works as a medical and court interpreter and over the years has served on the board of the Southeast Asian American Professionals Association, lobbied to get more locals hired at Merced's new UC campus, campaigned for Hmong politicians, and volunteered for the American Red Cross. He explains, for people like me, who were fortunate to go to school before we came to this country, we serve our community when we get here, and we end up serving all our lives. Jonas Vengay has completed a master's degree and a doctorate, earned California teaching credentials in French, Lao, Hmong, and mathematics,
and co-authored a 2-volume Hmong language textbook. He teaches Hmong and directs international student services at Merced College, where he was once selected by the Academic